Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to CrimeWire, an elite team of veteran investigation experts, along with noted crime consultants and attorneys, often featured on the popular news programs for families of violent crimes to find answers and seek justice. The CrimeWire team, Vito Colucci Jr., private investigator and author, Denny Griffin, retired investigator and author, Tom Shamshak, private investigator, and Susan Murphy Milano, a violence expert and author, are there, on top of the crime, at the top of their game. CrimeWire is the place for information, news, safety, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in anytime during the show. The number is 646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat room here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or family member and would like to send the CrimeWire team information on an unsolved or suspicious death case or want to be considered for a segment on a case for a future show, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. Susan has the night off.
Hey, Vito. Denny, good evening.
Good evening.
Our first case tonight is that of a soldier by the name of Patrick Rust. Sergeant Patrick Rust was assigned to the 10th Mountain Division, which is headquartered at Fort Drum in Watertown, New York. In January 2007, Sergeant Rust returned from deployment to Afghanistan. Following a 30-day leave, the sergeant was back on post. The then 24-year-old Sergeant Rust was a local boy and was very familiar with Watertown and the surrounding area. He didn't have a driver's license, nor did he have a vehicle. On Wednesday, March 14th, 2007, Sergeant Rust moved most of his personal effects from the barracks on base to share an apartment with a fellow soldier in Watertown. The following day, Sergeant Rust rode back to the apartment with his new roommate after they were both released from duty at around 5 o'clock that afternoon. At around 6:30, they left the apartment in the roommate's car and drove to the Salmon Run Mall. While there, Patrick purchased some games for his Game Boy video device in the Best Buy store located in the mall. They then went to the food court and got something to eat at a Wendy's. At about 7:50 p.m., the pair left the mall and split up a short time later, with the roommate stopping at a tanning salon and Patrick walking back to their apartment. The next reported sighting of Patrick Rust was between 9 and 10 o'clock that night. He was seen at a well-known gay and lesbian bar on Arsenal Street. The bar is called Clueless. It was an establishment Patrick had never been at before, and it is unknown why he went there that night. Patrick reportedly left the bar at around 1 in the morning on March 16th and disappeared. His skeletal remains were found 6 months later in a farmer's field about 5 miles outside of Watertown. How he got to that location is unknown, and his manner of death is undetermined. Joining us to discuss the latest developments in Patrick's case is forensic investigator and CrimeWire consultant Bill Sullivan. Our own Denny Griffin has been assisting Bill in this investigation for quite some time. Let's go straight out to Denny. Denny, take it over.
Thanks, Tom. And Bill Sullivan, welcome to CrimeWire.
Thank you, Denny. Glad to be here.
Now, as Tom mentioned, I've been involved for quite some time myself with the case. I'm next to you, probably as familiar with it as anyone. And what I'd like to do tonight is we've had Judy Rust, Patrick's mom, on in the past, but I wanted to have you update the listeners as to what's going on with the Patrick Rust case, what you found, and what's shaken out with it. So first, Bill, could you tell us what, if any, new developments there have been in the case?
Well, one of the new developments for us is I was able to obtain some more information through some police agencies, some reports, etc. Information that we didn't have before, and it revealed to us that what we had been told about various timelines and when he was last seen and information like that might not be 100% correct. So it's helped me revise a timeline into a couple of different scenarios. Also, I've received some technical information, which has helped us track a couple of 3 days' worth of information prior to his disappearance. Within the next month or two, we'll probably start re-interviewing some of the potential witnesses in this case and people that have been interviewed. We found most of the interviews that were conducted, and there were three different agencies involved, were quite lacking in the information that was obtained. And let's just say that these people need to be re-interviewed. So there's quite a bit of activity taking place, along with some new publicity that may be gathered in the case.
Yeah, and Bill, you mentioned the timeline. You know, there's that age-old saying about what happens when you assume.
Mm-hmm.
And when I first got looked at some of these documents last summer, I read the official timeline prepared by Army CID. And at that point, Patrick was being treated as an AWOL. Watertown yeah. City Police Department was also involved, and their case was a missing persons case. And subsequently, about 6 months later, when Patrick's remains were found outside of Watertown, it then became a county jurisdiction also. So that is the third agency now that's been involved in this. But I assumed the timeline prepared by CID was an accurate timeline. And I and others formed some opinions and did some things based on that timeline. And what you're saying now is that timeline is in itself suspect and may not, in fact, be the actual timeline. So we don't really know for sure where Patrick was at virtually any specific time or place. We know certain places he was, but the times he was there, in fact, may not be accurate. Is that a fair summation?
Yes, it is. And one of the problems has been the ability to retrieve reports in this case. All three agencies involved in the case flatly refused to give us a single report. And what we were able to get is some bits and pieces of reports from the Army, through the Army, and recently, now that the case is 4 years old, we've been able to obtain some more reports. And that's kind of changed everything.
Now, we've established, or at least that the timeline that's still the official timeline in the reports may not, in fact, be accurate. And, you know, one of our other Crime Wire consultants, Cherry Simpson, helped set up a website for Patrick, and she also posted his story and requests for information on various websites and chat rooms and so forth in and around Fort Drum in the Watertown, New York area. And I monitor them. In fact, I have a Google alert that if anything is posted about Patrick Rust, I'm informed by Google alert, and I visit the site or the chat room and so forth to see what's happening. And I'll tell you one scenario that has come up here, and it seems to at least initially have caught on with people and be taken as the truth, as a fact, and that is that Patrick was actively engaged in alternative lifestyle. And I can understand that when his last known sighting was at this gay and lesbian bar, I can certainly understand anyone raising that as an issue. But could you tell us, Bill, what you found in the way of Patrick's lifestyle to support this rumor that's out there, this one scenario that's floating out there that Patrick was actively engaged in this alternative lifestyle?
Right. I've not found a shred of evidence that he has had any type of alternative lifestyle, or anybody that has been interviewed has even mentioned that. The only thing that has any of that connected to it is the place where he was last seen, which I might add, in Watertown, New York, it's not strictly a real gay bar that one would think. It's a pretty regular bar that does have a little bit more of a gay clientele, but the regular folks go there also. And I don't mean regular folks. I mean other lifestyles participate at that bar just like any bar. You would not know, unless somebody mentioned that to you, that that was a gay bar. And I think more focus has been put on that, which may have absolutely nothing to do with the case, than the fact that this is a soldier that has died for unknown reasons, and there has been very little publicity. There's been very little, there wasn't any real searches for him when he went missing. It was very strange what's taken place here.
Bill, there's a couple of things now that the fact is, and I think this is one of the things I think that's been established without doubt, is that Patrick Rust had never been in the Clueless Bar prior to the night of March 15th, 2007. That is pretty clear. As you just said, you found no other evidence, if you want to call the fact that he was in the bar evidence. You found nothing in your inquiry so far to indicate that he was engaged in this alternate lifestyle. And there was another first for Patrick. The night prior, the 14th of March, he had moved in with this other soldier to a civilian housing unit. And he only spent the one night there because the next night, the 15th, is the night he disappeared and never came back. So there were two firsts involved. One was moving off base into the civilian, sharing this apartment with the fellow soldier, and the second was him never having been there before, ending up in this Clueless Bar. I don't know what you can read into that, but I find that the coincidence bothers me that he would move off base and the next night go to a bar he'd never been to before and end up dead. So that puzzles me. Yes, Vito?
Yeah, I mean, and thinking about the case, I'm listening to what you guys are saying here. Putting on the old police hat on my head, obviously I'd want to know if the new roommate belongs to the gay community, okay? Maybe somehow they met. I mean, obviously during the service, the whole bit, but if he, I'd like to know if he is gay, number one. Number two, because if he is, I mean, my next question to him is, okay, are you a lover of Rust in any kind of way? Are you guys together? Okay, because then that brings up the question of, okay, maybe the other guy did not know he was going to go to this bar on the way home and sees him or finds out afterwards and goes into a uproar. Now, that's just a suggestion because, you know, we're not working on the case that way like a cop, so I don't know for sure, but that is one direction. And also about the saying that he was never in there before, I think that's a difficult thing to say because people change their work shifts every couple of nights, unless somebody's there 7 nights a week. Now, you know, if everybody that they interviewed said, no, I never saw him in here before, it's a good chance he hasn't been. But, you know, like, what happened? You know, he's just ready to move in with this guy, and all of a sudden then he decides to stop at this place he never was in before. So like you said, Denny, there's a lot of stuff that kind of jumps out at you over here. You know what I mean?
Well,
absolutely,
Peter.
You make some good points, and I'll tell you, the one question you had, I want to clarify that because I can. The people who were interviewed, and I'm talking people I interviewed personally now, not something I got from somebody else's report. The manager of this bar, I spoke with personally. They were open, I believe, at that time, and they opened at night. They weren't open during the day. They opened in the evening. and he was the manager slash bartender. He had never seen Patrick before, and he worked every night.
Okay.
The girl who came in on weekends, and she came in, she was the door person who would check IDs. She had never seen Patrick in there before. The patrons that we talked to who had been in the bar before, now these are people that other people talked with. I didn't talk with them personally. They all said they had never seen Patrick in the bar before, and these people are regulars.
Okay.
So
okay, that's
it was strong suspicion that Patrick had, in fact, never been in there before. Because the manager told me he proofed Patrick, checked his ID that night because he had never seen him, didn't know him, and wanted to ID him. So I'm quite comfortable with saying that Patrick had, in fact, never been in the bar before. How about you, Bill? Did you find anything contrary
to that?
I
agree. And the other thing is this coincidence, and I know, Vito, what you're thinking. You don't believe in coincidences, neither do I. But just it so happens that this move in with this roommate was a planned move. And speaking to Patrick's father, Patrick had mentioned this to him almost a year ago, that when they both got back in the United States, they were going to move in together. I think they served, if I'm correct here, in Afghanistan together, and were good friends. The roommate is married, and, of course, his wife's at home, and he's stationed in Fort Drum. So they were separated, but and he had also just come back from overseas. So they had known each other a long time. Now, was he gay and was he a lover? I mean, that I don't know because we haven't interviewed him personally.
How about Bill? Tom, why don't you jump in on this? What do you feel you're hearing so far?
Well, I wanted to ask a different question here that will maybe change the perspective here for a second. What I would like to know is, what do you know specifically about the terminal circumstances of Patrick's death? Give me a geographical profile of where his skeletal remains were found. Is this location, off the beaten path, where only a local would know about it? What do we know about it? Was it on an elevation?
Well,
or what do we know about that?
It's a hayfield out in the country near a Bosie's school. There is a road, a dirt path, that would take you back into that area if you knew it was there. It's well off the roadway, I would say about a mile, surrounded by fields, hay fields. Not anywhere anyone would have any purpose of being. As I say, this dirt road is a couple of fields over, so to get where he was, you would have to be walked. You would have to walk through a couple of fields first, and we're assuming that this might have been in the middle of the night. He was last heard from at 1:30 in the morning and never heard from again. So,
all right. Telephone
he's
technology?
He's not dressed for it either.
No.
He's dressed not in winter clothing, and this is 18-degree weather, and it's cold. So He's not dressed for it. He doesn't have gloves on. He doesn't have a coat on, a heavy coat anyway. The clothes were so deteriorated, it looked like he might have had a little bit of a heavier shirt, maybe another shirt over it. But he's not dressed for being outside walking long distances. And he was known to walk a lot because he didn't have a driver's license.
Okay,
but
so now we
he's
have
really out of place.
Okay, so now the question is, did the roommate have any familiarity with that area that would take him out that way? And if not,
that's
then
a question that was never asked.
He intersected with somebody at that bar that perhaps took him for a ride.
That's possible, yes. And whoever took him for a ride knows the answer to this whole case. I'm just about sure of that.
Tom, you just mentioned telephone technology. There are certain things. Bill has come into possession of some phone records. And we found, I've had a chance to look at them, we found some odd things. Let me give you, for instance, when Patrick, their sergeant, the immediate supervisor of Patrick and the roommate, got a text message from the roommate at approximately 5:10 a.m. on the 16th. The text message was, "Patrick will not be coming to formation today. Do you want me to come in?" It wasn't a question or maybe, it was a declaratory statement. Patrick will not be at formation today. When this roommate was interviewed in a sworn written statement, he indicated that he had awakened about 1 a.m. and Patrick was not in. Patrick was not in the apartment. The CID investigator said, "Why did you wake up at 1 a.m.? What caused you to wake up?" And his response was, "I always get up at 1 in the morning to check my emails." Well, you know, I guess each individual can decide how credible
that
is.
Yeah, you fellas do that too, don't you?
Oh, yeah, I set my alarm for 3:15 every night just to see if my Aunt Philomena called me or sent me an email or a Facebook post. You know, Denny, one interesting thing, going back to all your introduction on this, what I'm feeling, and Chief, I want to see what you think about this too. I'm still a firm believer in polygraphs, okay, whether you're going to go through with them or not. I love facing a person I'm interviewing, okay, and all of a sudden saying to them, let's call this roommate Bob. Hey, Bob, okay, maybe would you be open to do a polygraph just so we can kind of knock you out of the box over here, clear you maybe, and move on to somebody else. You know, it's kind of routine we do, and we just like to maybe do that with you. Whether you're going to follow up on it or not, it's always that first reaction to the person. Their hand goes up to their mouth. Something happens. They start to fidget. I mean, and then, of course, their answer. You know, a lot of times people will say, "Oh, sure, yeah, I'm fine, set it up." A lot of times, you can see by the reaction. So, I mean, a lot of times I still love that tool, Chief. You agree with me or no?
I firmly agree with you that popping that question and then sitting back and observing the nonverbal communication is priceless.
And there was two offers in all the witnesses interviewed. There were two people that were asked to take a technical interview, which I believe they meant a polygraph. They didn't say polygraph, but I'm thinking that's what CID meant by a technical interview. And they were done after a two-sentence interrogation on the street corner of two very important individuals in this case. They both said, "Sure, we'll do a technical interview," and then, of course, refused later on in the case.
Mm.
When asked to sit down and grant an interview, they wouldn't do it.
What's their relationship
I told you about going on these different chat rooms and websites that Patrick has been mentioned on, and one of them, there's a posting from someone who claims to have worked with the roommate, worked with both of them, and that the roommate told this individual that he had been polygraphed by CID, and that it was, you know, he cooperated all he could, he passed with flying colors, but it was a very stressful experience. Bill, are you familiar or aware that the roommate was ever polygraphed?
Absolutely not. I don't see any evidence of that whatsoever. He was interviewed poorly twice, and the third time he declined to be interviewed to give a statement.
So he withdrew his cooperation after Patrick's remains were found. I believe that happened.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And another interesting thing, the roommate, after when he was interviewed initially after the disappearance back in March of 2007, before the remains were found, and the Army was involved in this as an AWOL situation, the CID investigator asked the roommate, "Okay, if you were Patrick, you know, if you were looking for Patrick, where would you look? Where do you think he would be?" And the roommate says, "Well, if I had $27,000 in the bank, I'd be in Canada unless I was already dead." I find that an interesting response. it wasn't really followed up on. But I would certainly want to know, I think, exactly what was meant by that. And it just so happens he was accurate on the dollar amount of Patrick's credit union account. But another interesting thing I thought when Tom was talking about cell phones is some people who have claimed that they attempted to reach Patrick that night,
mm-hmm.
we find that the phone records don't corroborate those statements. And people who claimed not to have been trying to get in touch with Patrick, or at least not frequently, in fact show up multiple times on the cell phone records. So there's, I think there are a lot of questions here to go around. What do you think, Bill?
Well, it's amazing how inaccurate, if the phone records are accurate, I'll say that. The leading theory was that somebody called, or Patrick called somebody at a certain time, and when you look in the record, it's just the other way around. That person called him, and it changes the whole tenor of what he was doing and where he was that night. If he was called and asked to meet him there, rather than he just happened to go there and see this person. So it's really confusing what the police have said publicly and what actually the story is. So we had no records before, so all we could base our theories on is what the police said. Now that we have obtained some records and we don't have, I bet you we don't have 50% of them, but we're a lot further now, and I actually expect this summer we can do a few interviews and clarify a lot of this.
I think so. This is one of those cases on Crime Wire we talk frequently about solvability factors, and this is one case I think that with some, a little diligence and a little effort, I think some answers could be had. I want to, Bill, before we run out of time, is talk about something just come up recently, too, in the publicity area, or to bring the case to the public's attention regarding billboards. Will you explain what's going on with that?
Well, I just happened to read a piece in the Post Standard about a professor at Syracuse University that has been, she's in the School of Communication and teaches advertising. And she had her students posting information on billboards, and they were kind of provocative billboards and really got people talking and thinking. So I've contacted her and asked her to assist us in putting information together on this case and possibly other cases across the United States, rather than the typical give us information and get a $1,000 reward, to see if we can stimulate people into thinking a little different and get a little bit more activity. And she has agreed to assist us in that and make her students available to help design these things. And as a professional, I would certainly enjoy her ideas on this and you fellas saying whether that idea would work before we do it. So I hope I can count on you guys to take a look at everything, too.
Hey, Denny?
Yes,
Denny, before we run out of time on this segment, just one closing note. You know, a lot of times, you know, Denny, and all of us know, a lot of people ask us why we do the show. You know, what do we hope to gain? What are we looking for? Have we had any success? Well, here's the perfect example of success, because the time you and Bill Sullivan have put in, I mean, and I'm giving you guys kudos because you're part of our whole big team here. You have stirred the pot on this case. You have found discrepancies. Things have been starting to change on it. Action has been taken. And, I mean, this has been very successful. Now, people may say, yeah, but the case isn't solved. But this case is staying active. Not only because of the police, but for the role of Denny Griffin and Bill Sullivan in this, because you guys are really delving into things. And I just want to say that before we end this section, because that's what this show and a lot of other shows that sometimes come on Blog Talk Radio is about, is to stir that pot and to get answers and to move in a certain direction. So I just want to say, you know, proud of you guys. You guys have really done some great work out there, and I'm sure our bloggers, our listeners feel the same way.
Well, I appreciate that.
You know, and I want to mention one other thing. We just got some news today that I'm very pleased about. Bill, do you want to tell them about Mr. Scott LaPointe?
Oh, as things will happen, my pathologist, who helps us, and he's been on this show before, has agreed to look at this case, even though there isn't much from a medical standpoint to look at. He consults on a lot of these for pro bono, and it turns out he knows Patrick Rust. He grew up in the same exact little town north of Watertown that Patrick Rust did, and he knows the entire family. And we didn't realize that until I started showing him the autopsy. I mean, how bizarre is that? So
certainly welcome news from my perspective, I'll tell you.
Yeah. So, but this case is one that's kind of getting to me a little bit. That, you know, here we have a soldier that went and fought for you and I and everyone. And it just seems to me like his death has been, you know, ignored. And it really needs to have a conclusion to it for the family, for everybody. So I'll tell you, we're gonna really try hard to get one.
I'm hoping and I'm optimistic that the next 3 or 4 months, you know, by the end of summer, we can come back and say that we have helped to bring the Rust family some resolution here and let them know what happened to their son and how he died and perhaps why he died. Billy Sullivan, thanks so much for being on, and I'll see you in a couple of weeks, and we'll get back.
All right. Good to speak with everybody tonight.
Likewise.
Thanks,
Bill.
Thank you, Bill.
Okay.
Okay, we're going to be moving on to the upcoming Casey Anthony trial. Now, unless you live on Mars or are one of the 4 people in our country that haven't heard of this, we're going to give you some information on that right now. Kaylee Marie Anthony went missing from Orlando, Florida in June 2008, just weeks before her 3rd birthday. When Kaylee's disappearance was finally reported to the authorities on July 15th by her grandparents, the door was opened to a case that quickly caught the public's attention. Casey Anthony, Kaylee's mother, told the police a series of stories about her daughter's disappearance that were rapidly exposed as lies. On October 14, 2008, Casey was indicted for the first-degree murder of Kaylee. And in December of that year, Kaylee's remains were found in the woods not far from her home. Jury selection in the case began yesterday. We're pleased to welcome to Crime Wire award-winning author Diane Fanning to the show to talk about her book, Mommy's Little Girl, The Story of the Death of Kaylee Anthony and What to Expect During the Trial. Diane, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Denny. It's good to be here.
Well, I'm Vito. Denny's the other guy, but that's okay.
Oh, sorry, Vito.
No, that's all right,
handsome
Diane.
Well, guys.
Welcome to the show. I mean, you know, you get these cases, right, Diane? Let's start with letting our listeners know how these cases become the nationwide high-profile case. All of a sudden, it piques the interest of all the people. People start to jump on it and want to know this and want to know that. And before you know it, it takes on a life even bigger than itself. Am I right? And this case has done that.
Yes, it has. And I think when you start with something that goes against all our societal precepts about motherhood and what it's supposed to mean, I think that immediately draws attention. Because mothers are supposed to care for their children. They are not supposed to harm them. They're supposed to protect them. And so I think that is so jarring to most of us that instantly draws attention. And then you've got a case that where there's a little girl, not only is she adorable, but her life has been thoroughly documented. There are videos, there are photographs, and those things are flying out through the media, and we're seeing them all. And there's so many images of this child. You can't help but to fall in love with the child. And then there's Casey. The pictures of her partying are coming out everywhere. And it all just sort of snowballs until this case is really bigger than life.
Right. You know, I heard today, Diane, too, on the news, and I was surprised to hear it, that this case here, the Casey Anthony trial, has gotten the most requests for credentials, and what that means to our listeners, entrance into the courthouse, being able to go there, cover it as a reporter. Since my case, the Michael Skakel case, and that's 9 years ago, that's 2002. So it's amazing that this place is going to be absolutely mobbed with the camera crews and all of that kind of things, right?
Yes, it will be. They've already got a place they gather together with their vehicles called Casey Town. So the media is in full party frame. This is a massive feeding frenzy. And they've said that already, someone did an analysis and said, already at this point in time, there has been more coverage, press coverage of this trial in this case than there was of O.J. Simpson.
I know, it's amazing. And another thing that, Diane, as you know, another thing that's not touched sometimes on this case is the crowd control, okay? I mean, I've been in the midst of these things before. And, I mean, you got the state police that get involved. You got all kinds of different agencies, because you have people, you got to tell people where to park, how to act. You put all your news people, they're roped in a certain area. You need somebody to make sure somebody doesn't try to shoot this young girl or things of that nature. So there's all that behind the scenes. I remember on the several big trials that I've been involved with, there's meetings on a daily basis at the courthouse to secure everything and to have guards and state police. So there's all that behind-the-scenes things that you know about, Diane, too, right?
Well, yeah, and it's like when I did the Michael Peterson trial, something happened. There was some sort of security snafu, and all of a sudden the courtroom was cleared, and media who previously could just come in, show our media pass, and nobody would have to look at our stuff. Well, suddenly we had to go through the metal thing just like everybody else.
Sure.
So it was, you know, one little wrong thing happens, and the next thing you know, they're cracking down, and they take it all very, very seriously. Not one of those deputies or state police wants to have a defendant shot while he's trying to get a fair trial.
Oh, definitely. That's when they're going to work out, you know, coming in through cellar doors or coming a certain way in the wagon and all kinds of things of that nature. But what's your thoughts on it? I know we talked about what we're doing here now, but what's your thoughts on this case? What do you feel is, I hate to jump to the outcome, but what do you feel the outcome is going to be of this?
I think there is going to be a guilty verdict. I doubt if they will give the death penalty. I do think there is a possibility of a hung jury, but I see no way possible that there could be an acquittal.
Right. And you know what's important, too, before I open it up for Denny and Tom to jump in, too, here with you, Diane, just one illustration I want to make here, which I have found over the years. The jury selection process, the trial itself with the jury. People sometimes don't realize, okay, yeah, they got the jury picked, fine. But the importance of that, and I'm going to give one quick example. I know I've said this before. Okay, I'm going to go back again to the Michael Skakel, Martha Moxley case. Every prosecutor across the country, everybody on television at that time said, I don't want that case. That's a no-win case for the prosecution. They're never going to convict this guy, blah, 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 blah. Okay, what happens? He's convicted. Fast forward 2 years after that, the next nationwide case, the Jason Williams case, famous basketball player from the New York Nets, shot his chauffeur. Mm-hmm. People were saying to me, why are you even getting involved in that? He got the gun, he shot the guy, blah, blah, blah. That's the end of it. He was found not guilty on all the big charges, and like I've said before, the front page headline in all the New York papers, the Post and the Daily News, was a comment from the jury. He didn't look like a cold-blooded killer to us. Now, no one said the evidence didn't show or this didn't happen. Their topic, their thing that they said afterwards, he didn't look like a cold-blooded killer to us. So people, our listeners, need to realize, and then Denny and you, Diane, and everybody can jump in, how important that is, because I've stopped trying to gauge juries after those two cases, okay? So,
yeah.
I mean, what do you think about that,
Diane? Today, the jury selection is not going very smoothly either. Perry said it should take us a week, that seemed like a really Herculean task. knowing what we were dealing with here, with all this media saturation. And then today, you know, it's like almost like if there's not something weird and quirky to happen, it's not the Casey Anthony case. So today, who shows up in the jury pool but someone who's also on the witness list? Now, you would think that most people know enough about the justice system that that means when you get to the courthouse, you immediately grab a deputy or someone at the clerk's office and you tell them the situation so they can get you out of there because you're not wanted there. But no, this person doesn't. He sits with a group of 48 other people,
mm-hmm.
and they're getting ready to go before the judge, and they're sitting there and chatting, and he tells them that he's a volunteer. He was a volunteer for Texas Equal Search, and he's on the witness list. And so they want to know from him everything about the case that he knows. So he's talking to them all about the case.
Oh, jeez.
So here they are having trouble finding jurors, and they had to dismiss all 49 of those people.
And you know, Diane, what's amazing, too, again, I heard today, not only is this time-consuming for a person to be on a jury, we all know that, but this jury is going to be sequestered for possibly up to 2 months. So that means you have no life, no life whatsoever
right.
for 2 months. So now, but that opens up the door. I'm saying all that. That opens up the door for that person that wants to come in and really wants to serve on this jury because that's the biggest case in the country, and I want to be able to make money on this afterwards. So do you follow where I'm going with it, Diane? Because for somebody to say, oh, yeah, lock me in a hotel room for 2 months and I have no life or something, I know I have to do my civil duty, but, man, after those 2 months, everybody's going to want to talk to me and know me. Am I correct?
Yes, yes. It's there's people out there that want to get on that jury, and that's what they're thinking. And sometimes they can be spotted. Sometimes they're just a little bit too eager, and someone will pick up on that. You know, one of the attorneys or a jury expert will pick up on the behavior and the little tells they make with body language. So, you know, they're there. You know they're in the group. And you just got to find them and weed them out if you can.
That's it. Denny and Tom, questions for Diane or your observations now in this case. It's going to be a blockbuster trial. It's going to be amazing.
Denny, go ahead.
Yeah, Diane, nice talking with you again. It's been a while.
Yes, it has been, Denny. Good to hear your voice again.
Same here. Listen, I had a couple of questions. You've already addressed, you and Vito, some of them, but I was wondering, first of all, you know, they're talking that this is going to rival O.J. or perhaps surpass O.J.'s trial as far as interest goes. Do you think that had it not been for the initial reporting of this case, that it was reported by the grandparents after several weeks, what, about a month or so, or at least a few weeks, that Kaylee had been missing. And then the series of lies that the job at Universal Studios, Zanny the Nanny, you know, all this kind of stuff. Had it not been for that, had Casey just called the police, said, hey, my daughter's missing, I don't know what happened to her, and then clammed up, even though her remains were subsequently found. Do you think there would have been the hoopla over this, or do you think the conduct of Casey and then George and Cindy, the grandparents, do you think all that made this into the case it is, or it would have been that way anyway?
If Casey had reported her daughter missing early on, like right around the time that she died, this would have been searching for a missing child, there probably would have been some coverage because, you know, the videos and all those photographs are compelling. And you know that if Cindy thought her granddaughter was missing, she would have been funneling them out in that case just as she did when it happened. And so I think that did it. And I think people were pretty outraged at the audaciousness of her lies and how she thought she could bluff the police into thinking she had a job at Universal. It was one of the most brazen things I've ever seen. I mean, you know, you lead a pack of cops onto the place of your employment and walk them a couple blocks outside and then into a building where you're claiming your office is. What did she think? They were going to go, oh, okay, you really mean it. We don't need to check. I mean,
and before I give up the floor here, the other thing, a lot of people, including myself, are speculating on what the defense strategy is going to be. I'm not really sure at this point what they're actually going to do. I know there have been several, what do you call them, trial balloons floated. You know, George Anthony may have done it, and he abused Casey as a child and all that kind of stuff. And then they got a couple of the boyfriends. Was one of the boyfriends involved in this thing? Was actually, and for a while, the meter man that discovered the remains. You know, he was actually the culprit or involved in it. And I don't really know where they're going with this. Do you have a solid idea of how you think the defense is going to just plan their strategy here?
They seem to be saying it was anybody but Casey, and they are going to try to prove that it wasn't Casey because it was someone else. Now, I think they are probably maintaining a fluid and flexible stance to get through the state's presentation of case before they really decide on what seems the most viable and how exactly to go about it. They probably have several alternate plans drawn out. I think one of the most telling things was when they did not want Cindy and George in the courtroom. That says that they find them unpredictable, and they would like to keep open the opportunity to be able to attack them freely. And they can't do that with them in the courtroom. I mean, particularly, Cindy is so volatile. If they did that with her sitting in there, she could rise up and start screaming.
Good, that's a good point. Tom Shamchak, former chief of police. Tom, either some observations on your part or any questions for Diane?
Diane, good evening. What's your take on the limited recent exposure of the brother here? We haven't seen him at all. No discussion, nothing.
Well, there was a story that he had some sort of an agreement with the state, and he gave them information, and they were agreeing not to prosecute him for some knowledge he had, and what that was, I don't know. There were meetings with his attorney. There were a number of meetings with his attorney and the prosecutor, and then suddenly, boom, Lee was completely out of the spotlight, gone.
It's like he's in the witness protection program.
Yeah. It's, you're not hearing anything about it. He is laying so low. You'd have to tear up the grass to find him, I think.
Yet I recall at the memorial service for the child, he was out there speaking cryptically about CMA. I love you, CMA. Now, was he referring to his sister or to his niece?
Well, you know what? I think he was just being an ass. I think that was it.
He was intentionally
being cryptic. He thought he was amusing and smart and bright, and he was kind of showing off to the world. That's what I think.
I'm cynical. My lengthy experience with the dregs of society has tainted me. And I just think there's more to his involvement in this as a possible player, perhaps after the fact. And I'm just, you know, speculating that I think it's going to be a blockbuster trial. I think it'll be on the cover of most magazines for a while, and the nation will be focused on it.
I think so too. And you know, back when O.J. Simpson made his little scamper in his white vehicle across Los Angeles, Yeah, we watched that, but how many live news channels were really doing something like that? There was CNN, and there wasn't a whole lot more at that time. There wasn't all these shows that focus just on crime, live shows like Nancy Grace and Jane Velez Mitchell and several others. So that really magnifies it all.
Yeah.
Diane,
well,
why don't you tell our listeners? Oh, I'm sorry, Tom. Go ahead.
No. Go ahead.
No, I just wanted Diane, before we run out of time, to tell our listeners a little bit about her book, Mommy's Little Girl, why you wrote it, and what's been the reaction to it so far, and how people can get it, Diane.
Well, Mommy's Little Girl started, I mean, I didn't think I'd be writing the book. I was following the case from July 15th. The whole scenario as it played out before our eyes was just so fascinating to me. And then when she was arrested in October, the publisher wanted me to write the book, and he contacted my agent. So I agreed to write it and got busy working on it right away. And it was a thing that really consumed my life. Not only were there so many people to talk to, you know, but before I finished writing the book, I had 8,000 pages of documents. It was it was unbelievable, you know, and you just have to go through that. And you know how those court documents are. Some of it's page out of page after page of nothing, but buried there in one of the pages in the middle is this little tidbit that is vital. So, you know, you have to pore over everything. And so it was an arduous task. It's been accepted very well. I mean, there have been, of course, people that criticize it for whatever reason. But when the book first came out that first week, it was number two in nonfiction sales in retail stores of paperbacks across the country.
Wow, excellent.
So,
excellent.
Yeah.
And
right
now,
can
people get that now?
You can get it on Amazon either as a paperback or on Kindle, and you can get it from Barnes & Noble as a paperback or as a Nook book. And there are a lot of stores across the country that are stocking this book right now because the trial is coming up. And so a lot of people have started stocking it again. So you can find it in a lot of drugstores, grocery stores even, in addition to bookstores.
Yeah, well, it's going to be definitely interesting case, that's for sure. And I know many very high-profile defense attorneys across the country whose logic all the time is just give me two jurors. Sometimes people think they're saying one. The really good ones want two jurors that are not going to budge from their what they're feeling on it. You know, because when you look at this case, and what is that guy, a meter reader who we're talking about? That was his
Roy
Kron. Yes.
Yeah, he worked for a utility company for the city, yeah.
Now, let's say he's totally innocent of this whole thing, okay? And I've said this on other shows. They are going to, once he gets on the stand, he's going to walk off of there, not even remember what his name is. He's going to be so confused about it because that poor soul is going to dread the day he picked up the phone and called. And that's a shame. If he's totally innocent of this, it's a shame. That's bad commentary for the person that calls in something and just wants to help out, you know. But you know yourself, Diane, or all four of us here, Denny, Tom, myself, and you know what happened when people get on the witness stand in the biggest case in the country. Okay, they're going to after him as well as anybody else that the prosecution puts on there. It may be smoke and mirrors, but they still want to get it where those people go back in the jury room and a couple of them look at each other and say, "I'm totally confused." And you know, you hate to say it, but a lot of times that's what the defense wants. He wants people to say, I really can't make a decision on this. It could have been that Kronk guy, or I don't know. And, you know, the listeners need to understand, all four of us have been involved and have sat front row at these trials. It's amazing the nervousness and everything. Tell our listeners how that all works, Diane, and what these people go through.
Well, you know, what you say about two is really right, because one person can sometimes be worn down by the other 11. But when it's
right,
two people, it's easier to stand strong, and even against a majority. And they get in there, And suddenly there's been a lot of information thrown at them for days. There were times they were tired, maybe they didn't sleep well that night before, so they might not have absorbed evidence and testimony that day as well as they had on others. So there will be little holes in everybody's understanding to some degree. Some will be worse than others. And the only thing you can hope is like someone on the jury has the knowledge to help explain things. Like anything that has a scientific component in it, in the evidence, is going to be difficult for some people to comprehend what it means and how it works. And if the prosecution is lucky, you'll have somebody with some scientific or medical background that can help people understand what this all means. You know, sometimes one nurse on a jury can make all the difference in the world, can explain one unclear concept involved in the death. And you just need to have a group of people that are getting along, and that is usually an easy thing to happen because they're the only people in your life, you know, except for the deputies. And but sometimes that goes bad. Sometimes there's rivalries and little mini feuds, and that complicates the whole thing even more. And people then also sometimes get suddenly freak out when they realize they have in their hands the power to make or break a person's life.
Mm.
And they start getting nervous about it and anxiety-ridden, and, you know, they don't want to be the one that takes this person and puts them in jail for the rest of their life. They just don't want to do it, and they don't know how they ended up there because they don't like to judge people.
That's right. That's a good point. Go ahead, Tom.
I was just going to say, but, you know, here, a picture's worth a thousand words. This woman, Kaylee Marie Anthony, is a poster child for malevolence. You talked earlier about her. Her behavior is incongruent with our societal precepts. If they show some of that video, I mean, I think it's a foregone conclusion that she'll be found guilty, whether or not. When it comes to you know, the death penalty decision, you know, there again, now they're, you know, they're, that I think is much more difficult to do than to come down with a decision in this case. This is a horrible case.
Well, you know, and the thing of it is she essentially looks like a presentable human being in the courtroom. She doesn't look like some slatternly slob that was picked up off the street and sat in the defense chair. She looks like she doesn't look like she's ready to be violent, you know, so she doesn't look bad. She could be better, but she doesn't look bad in there. She looks like somebody they could know. So that's going to make, that makes it harder to give the death penalty. Her age makes it harder.
Right.
Her,
right.
You know, and the fact that, well, you know, the only record she has is stealing money from her grandmother. I mean, that's not exactly murder. So it's going to be, it's going to be difficult for a lot of people, and quite frankly, for young.
Diane, before we run out of time, I wanted to address the issue of George and Cindy.
Yes.
There are some people who look at them as victims. They lost their granddaughter and so forth, and look at them sympathetically. But I think there's a majority, in my opinion, that don't like them, that their conduct. It has been found by a lot of people to be reprehensible during this thing. And there's floating around out on the Internet and so forth that, well, maybe after this trial is over with, George and Cindy will get their comeuppance based on criminal charges for possibly obstructing evidence tampering and those types of things. Do you see, first of all, do you agree with me? Do you think that they have not endeared themselves to a lot of people the way they conducted themselves during this whole episode? And also, do you think there's any chance that prosecutors would go after them? First, do they have any reason to go after them? And secondly, would they even want to after this trial is over?
Well, I think that I think some people in the general public did not give them enough time and did not give them enough space and understanding for some of their actions that just seemed, you know, over the top or kind of crazy. Because, quite frankly, it is difficult to be the family members of a victim. It is also difficult to be the family members of a perpetrator. And these people were suddenly both. And that's a very hard, hard place to be. So I was willing, up to a point, to give them the benefit of the doubt. And that point came when Cindy intentionally and knowingly gave a hairbrush to the law enforcement that had been used by just about everybody in the family instead of giving him the one that had been exclusively used by Kaylee. That was when she crossed the line for me. That was beyond the pale. Do I think that they'll get charged afterwards? You know, after they get a conviction on Casey Anthony, I'm not sure they're going to have the stomach to deal with this case anymore. And that happens a lot of times, that you know, there's going to be an appeal. And so if they start throwing charges at other family members, regardless of what the charges are, the defense can take that and use it as some sort of wedge issue when it comes to either a new trial or to show how there was something wrong since the prosecutors delayed that long in arresting and charging them.
We've exceeded our time limit, and we could go on for another half hour. But listen, I hope you'll come back. We're not going to be doing the Anthony case 24/7, but periodically we'll probably do updates. I hope you'll consider coming back on at some point during the trial.
I would be delighted.
Okay, and thank you very much for being with us tonight, and we'll be in touch with you on some follow-ups.
Thank you, Denny, Vito, and Tom. Later.
Thank you.
Diane. And thanks to the CrimeWire team, Director of Research Kim Colton, and Public Relations team at ImaginePublicity.com. Our next show will be next Tuesday, May 17th. Tune in as we continue to analyze cases and crimes that wreak havoc on families looking for answers and seeking justice.
Thank you for joining us tonight on CrimeWire. We always welcome your support and value you as our guests. If you would like your case to be featured on CrimeWire, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. To hear a rebroadcast of tonight's show, go to www.crimewire.blogspot.com. Turn on the volume at your computer, and the show will automatically play.
Remember, we ensure that your voices will be heard when there is nowhere else to turn. Visit our website at www.crimewiresite.com. God bless from the CrimeWire team, Vito Colucci Jr., Denny Griffith, Tom Shanshak, and Susan Murphy Milano. Thank you, good night, and God bless. Bye-bye.
Good night, everyone.
Good night. Good night.